Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes finding the nub of a story is as easy as doing a little math. 9 years ago, Daimler paid $36 billion to buy Chrysler. This morning, Daimler announced it'll sell Chrysler to a private equity group for almost $7.5 billion. Add it up, and anybody can see the deal's a net loss for Daimler. The deeper you dig, though, the worse the math gets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 14th of May. Great to have you with us on this Monday. You know, the corporate press release can be an interesting thing. Take, just for instance, today's announcement from Daimler Chrysler that Cerberus, one of the big U.S. private equity outfits, will be buying Chrysler. That's what the first paragraph alluded to, anyway.
Cerberus will make a capital contribution of $7.4 billion.
A $7.5 billion contribution in return for an 80% stake in the new Chrysler holding company. Fine as far as it goes, and then you keep reading.
$5 billion will flow into Chrysler Corporation, and $1.05 billion will flow into the financial services business.
That is not into Daimler's bank account, but into getting Chrysler and its financing arm up and running. The press release goes on.
Daimler Chrysler will receive the balance of $1.35 billion.
But it really won't, because Daimler really wants the deal to work out, so it's sweetening the pot a little bit.
Daimler Chrysler will grant a loan of $400 million to Chrysler,
which comes out of the $1.35 billion Daimler gets. And let's remember, Chrysler's not exactly the healthiest car company around right now. It's in the middle of laying off 13,000 employees.
Due to the Chrysler Group's anticipated negative cash flow until closing in connection with its restructuring plan, the transaction will give rise to a cash outflow of $1.6 billion for Daimler Chrysler.
Which is to say, once you take the $7.4 billion, subtract the money that's going to the new Chrysler, not Daimler, add in the Daimler loan, plus what it costs to keep Chrysler running till the deal actually gets done, you get, once again from Daimler's own press release,
the overall net cash outflow resulting from the transaction will therefore be $650 million.
Outflow, of course, equals money spent. So 9 years later, Daimler has to spend another $650 million to get somebody to take a $36 billion investment in Chrysler off its hands. Micheline Maynard is the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. Mickey, good to talk to you again.
Hello, Kai.
How bad can it possibly be that Daimler's actually willing to in essence, pay money to get rid of Chrysler?
Well, I guess it could be worse. They could be stuck with Chrysler. And in fact, there has been sort of a parallel track of trying to figure out, you know, if we can't find a buyer for Chrysler, what would we do with it? But, you know, Daimler Chrysler is just ready to get rid of Chrysler and go back to being Mercedes. Its shareholders have been beating on it for years, telling it, you know, get rid of this albatross. Let us go back and be a luxury car division again.
Why, given all the problems that cars worldwide now are having, why would Cerberus want to spend this kind of money to get into the car business?
Well, they certainly see some value in Chrysler. And indeed, just 18 months ago, Chrysler posted a profit in 2005. The problem is when car companies go bad, they go really, really bad. And you can see your revenues and your profits just dribble away quickly.
Right. So how much fun is that if you're up $1.5 billion 1 year and down $1.75 billion the next?
Well, it's interesting. I think hopefully for Chrysler under Cerberus, we might see some stability. I mean, the idea is that if anybody's business model could change, Chrysler is the best possibility.
Is Chrysler, in effect, going to disappear now?
Chrysler will disappear from the public radar. It certainly won't disappear from the automotive scene. But, you know, this is the big question for those of us who cover the automobile industry and are used to getting statistics on companies, you know, just at the click of a mouse. I've covered some private companies or a couple of airlines that are private, but there's really no parallel for this in as big of a company in the automobile industry.
Do you think that what might happen with many private equity deals might happen here? That is to say, Chrysler would be stripped down, sold off, and then somehow taken public again at some great profit to the people who own Cerberus?
Well, in fact, a month ago, union leaders here in Detroit were warning of just that. Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, had said he was afraid that a private equity company would strip and flip Chrysler. And today, actually, Mr. Gettelfinger came out and he said he thought the deal was in the best interests of Chrysler workers. I think there is a very real fear. I mean, there are some attractive assets at Chrysler. There's the Jeep brand. It has a beautiful headquarters and product development building in Auburn Hills. It has many, many dealerships that would be attractive to, say, the Chinese if they wanted to come into America and sell their own car. So there are definitely things there that Cerberus could strip and flip if it chose to do so. It's saying that it will not do that. But, you know, private equity is sort of in the business to make money. And if they think they need to make money, they'll sell something.
Yeah. Are there going to be any goods coming out of this, you think?
What I think might happen out of this is that fresh eyes will take a look at Detroit. The people involved in Cerberus, there's a gentleman named David Thursfield, who was a Ford executive, and then Wolfgang Bernhardt, who was the president of Chrysler. You know, they were always people pushing their companies to move faster, cut deeper, become part of this swiftly moving global auto industry. You know, it could rejuvenate Chrysler. It could finally break it away from the old Detroit mold and get it into the sort of third lane of traffic with the faster moving car companies.
You know, just to spin that off for a second, you and I have talked about this before, about how the restructuring of the car industry is nowhere near done yet. Is this a seminal moment, do you think?
I really think this is a seminal moment. I mean, I've been saying for years that one of the Detroit car makers would not survive in its present form. And I think that the door just opened to a real change at Chrysler.
Micheline Maynard in the Detroit Bureau of the New York Times. She runs that office. Mickey, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As Mickey mentioned, UAW Chief Ron Gettelfinger had a striking change of heart about Cerberus taking over Chrysler. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Ron Gettelfinger was so opposed to a deal with Cerberus, he traveled to Daimler Chrysler headquarters in Stuttgart over the weekend to talk the CEO out of it. But something changed his mind. David Cole directs the Center for Automotive Research. He says the bottom line is if Chrysler goes under, workers will go down with it.
The only job security that the workers in Chrysler, whether they're the hourly or salary workers, have is with a successful Chrysler.
Cole says no doubt costs will be cut. Cerberus's plans aren't clear yet, but Chrysler is laboring under an estimated $19 billion in retiree health care and pension liabilities. And Martha Gravatt fears the worst. She's worked for Chrysler for almost 20 years as a tool and die maker. She says private equity firms like Cerberus are known for buying distressed companies only to close plants and lay off workers.
And then they sell the company that they have shrunk to someone else for many times what they paid for it. That's what they're in business to do.
Cerberus insists it's focused on long-term results, but if that does involve cuts in jobs or benefits, it could affect workers at all three U.S. automakers. The UAW's current contract expires in September, and analysts say Ford and GM will try to match any concessions workers at Chrysler make. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Some of this, some of that on Wall Street today, mostly that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court gave the Environmental Protection Agency a little talking to about carbon dioxide, about how it and other greenhouse gases are indeed pollution and so can be regulated. With that decision as backdrop, the president made a stop in the Rose Garden today. He directed his cabinet to come up with rules that would lead to a 20% cut in gasoline use in this country within 10 years. And I was thinking here that you've heard about that plan before. You did, in the State of the Union speech 5 months ago. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The president ordered the Transportation and Agriculture Departments, along with the Environmental Protection Agency, to put together a plan to encourage alternatives to gasoline that would also cut tailpipe pollution.
This is a complicated legal and technical matter, and it's going to take time to fully resolve. Yet it is important to move forward, so I have directed members of my administration to complete the process by the end of 2008.
Just weeks before the end of his term, administration officials say it takes time to consider the costs and benefits to the environment and the economy, craft regulations, and put them out for public comment. Bob Greco is with the American Petroleum Institute.
In order to take into account the impact this could have on the nation's economy, its fuel use, and economic growth, it's important that the president does hear from all sides on this in a reasoned and deliberative fashion.
Environmentalists, though, accuse the president of bogging the process down in bureaucracy. Darren Lovas is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
It's unclear whether the president is actually going to lead this growing parade that's forming to do something about global warming and energy security, or if he's going to try to slow it down.
Congress, Lovas says, is already working on legislation to require more efficient cars and encourage alternative fuels. States, too, are clamoring for federal permission to crack down harder on air pollution. White House officials counter the federal government has spent more than any other country on studying climate change and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's almost a given in this day and age. You've got to be careful about what you do online, whether it's nasty emails about a colleague or sending your credit card number to a hacker. That state of affairs makes it all the more interesting that today is the deadline for some internet companies to make sure the government can tap into their systems, specifically companies that provide DSL or cable internet access and VoIP. The idea is to protect Americans from crimes being hatched on the web, and regular phone companies have had to let the feds in since 1994. But Ashley Milne-Tite reports that once you start getting the internet involved, compliance becomes much more complicated and so more expensive.
Regular person-to-person phone lines have been relatively easy to tap, but, says telecom consultant Scott Cleland,
in the internet age, you have voice over IP or VoIP, where people's conversations are broken up into bits and sent out over the internet and reassembled. And so it makes it a little more challenging technologically to be able to tap and listen into those kinds of calls.
The same goes for emails. Privacy advocates have spoken out against the extra layer of surveillance, but Cleland says companies accept it, some more willingly than others.
As a corporate matter, you're not seeing companies say, no, we don't want to cooperate with the United States government to protect U.S. citizens.
Still, he says meeting the government's compliance standards is a hassle. Daniel Berninger with Tier 1 Research says there's a lack of clarity, which could cause companies to get in legal trouble down the line. And then,
what's absolutely missing right now is sort of this efficacy, you know, is this useful based on what we're spending?
And he says companies are spending plenty to obey the new law.
Let's say you honestly really want to comply, you could probably spend 20-30% of your end user revenue trying to comply.
Overall, Berninger says companies will spend billions. Both men agree that one thing's for certain, though. The new compliance costs will soon be passed on to consumers. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The Senate's working on immigration reform this week. Bipartisan immigration reform, that is. Most Republicans didn't like last year's bill too much. The package currently in the works puts border security first. Then a high-tech ID system for undocumented workers would kick in. Only after that might millions of illegal immigrants get a chance at legal status. Once Congress went to the Democrats, speculation was it'd be easier for a deal to get done. But commentator Jeff Birnbaum says opposition to a key vote on Wednesday might come from a surprising source.
The conventional wisdom is that, after years of frustration on the issue, President Bush could well get a new immigration law. But for that to happen, Bush will have to partner with a broad swath of Democrats in charge on Capitol Hill. The reason? Most of his fellow Republicans are none too keen about giving foreign workers the chance to become citizens just because they've lived here for a while, and that provision would be the heart of any comprehensive solution. It turns out, though, the Democrats aren't all that eager to embrace the change. In fact, a large number of Democrats are likely to resist, and here's why. Labor unions, a fundamental constituency of the Democratic Party, are deeply divided on the topic. Luckily for Bush, two of the nation's largest and most influential unions, the Service Employees International Union and Unite Here, the Hotel and Sewing Workers Union, are eager to include a program that would allow foreigners to work temporarily in this country. They envision eventual citizenship, too, a plan similar to one that Bush has advanced in the past. These unions, which tend to represent lower-paid workers, foresee a lot of future members in that expanding labor pool. But almost every other union, including the big union federation, the AFL-CIO, does not like that proposal at all. In fact, they oppose a so-called guest worker program, worrying that the additional foreign workers would take away Americans' jobs, including those their members now hold. They intend to fight such a program with all the strength they have. That leaves Democratic lawmakers with a difficult choice. Some will go with Bush, but others will go with the majority of unions, and that could well prevent the president from winning on immigration this year.
Jeff Birnbaum's a columnist for The Washington Post. If you want to send us your comments, online is the way to do it. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Just click on the link that says contact. Small businesses and their workers coming up next. They take their medicine on healthcare.
It's a tough pill to swallow, but, you know, you don't really have any control over it. I mean, the company's had to pay a lot more also, so what are you really going to do?
But first, let's do the numbers. Fear of the unknown, specifically jitters over tomorrow's key consumer inflation numbers, brought mixed signals from Wall Street today. At one point, the Dow Industrials touched a new intraday high, only to fall back to a more modest gain. The blue chips picked up 20 points, a tenth of 1%, to wrap up trading at 13,346. The Nasdaq lost 15 points, around two-thirds of 1%, closing at 2546. The S&P 500 edged lower 2 points, not quite two-tenths of 1%, to finish at 1503. The deal to sell Chrysler boosted the auto sector, which was a primary driver for the Dow. Shares of General Motors and Ford revved up around 4%, while Daimler Chrysler stock bumped up around 2.5%. Bond prices fell. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 4.7%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archives section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for April. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee discusses the oil and gasoline outlook for summer. And a conference focuses on dark matter. No, not the latest Stephen King novel or even The New Black. It's science. NASA discusses the strongest evidence to date that dark matter exists. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a great lesson to be learned from the U.S. Postal Service today about the time value of money. Postage rates went up 41 cents for a first-class stamp, but you can buy something called a forever stamp for that same 41 cents that'll be good forever, no matter how high postage rates rise. Spend now, save later. The one rate that didn't go up today but will in July is for mailing periodicals. The new rate structure for magazines and the like is so complicated it'll take that long to get all the software up to date. From Washington, Jeremy Hobson reports that for some small magazines, it's a welcome delay.
Usually, the liberal magazine The Nation and the conservative Weekly Standard don't find themselves on the same side of an argument, but the huge postal rate increases they both face are enough to bring them together. Weekly Standard publisher Terry Eastland says the new rates will either mean higher subscription fees or significant cutbacks.
It is such a precipitous increase, coming with really such short notice and with so little time in which to make adjustments, that it seems to me it becomes especially onerous.
At The Nation, President Teresa Stack says she's looking at $500,000 a year in extra mailing costs, and she knows other small publications face the same pain.
Most of these magazines aren't profitable to begin with, so how we adapt to that kind of increase is something we're struggling with.
Small publications say they didn't have enough time to figure out what the plan would do to their bottom lines before it was pushed through. Normally, the Postal Service sends its proposed rate structure over to the Postal Regulatory Commission, an independent government agency. The commission gives it the okay and sends it back so it can be approved, but this year, that didn't happen. The Postal Regulatory Commission rejected the Postal Service's plan, and after a public comment period, the commission went with a version that Time Warner helped craft. It gives the best rates to publications that do more business with the Postal Service, like People and Time Magazine, published by Time Warner. Bob McChesney, who runs an organization called Free Press, is bringing small publishers together to challenge the new rates.
We have approved this dramatic rate change, this complete overhaul of periodical rates. It goes into effect in July. The Postal Service itself says it won't necessarily know till June what the exact rates will be for publications. I mean, we might be driving off a cliff and no one knows.
But there are those who argue that it's fair for companies who do more mailing to pay less, especially when they engage in work sharing. Time Warner often does much of the post office's job. They bundle, they sort, they transport, everything except delivering the magazines to your door. Gene Del Polito runs the Association for Postal Commerce, which represents companies including Time Warner.
And all they've asked is that, look, since we've gone through these extra steps, understanding that postal costs are rising, isn't it time that these efficiencies be reflected in the rates we are asked to pay?
You pay for what you use.
That's how Postal Regulatory Commission Chairman Dan Blair sees it.
And if you're going to use the full freight of the postal system, it's going to cost you more than if you can do a number of these things yourself.
Publishers of small periodicals argue that'd be fine if magazine mailing were competitive. But it's not. The Postal Service has a monopoly, and small magazines have no other choice. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
As much of a pain in the you-know-what as it can be to find good health insurance, it can be worse for companies. If they want to get and keep good workers, they'd better have a decent package. But just as for consumers, health insurance can be hard for employers to find and expensive when they do find it. The smaller a business is, the bigger those problems usually become. So you might think entrepreneurs would have one well-defined message as the healthcare debate heats up. Like everything else with healthcare, though, it's not quite that simple. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli is at the entrepreneurship desk. He's been following the health insurance challenge for those small businesses.
The bite of insurance costs is more dramatic when you see it directly from a small factory's floor.
This is the largest of the units that we make, and it's a portable wind choice.
Lincoln Precision Machining outside Boston makes hoists and winches for lifting things. The company struggles with costs and competition, but it's holding its own for now. When I first visited the company in 1999, it had 26 employees. Health insurance coverage for a family cost $460 a month back then, and the company paid for all of it. Today, Lincoln's down to 22 employees, and family health insurance premiums have tripled. They're nearly $1,500 a month now. And workers pay a share of that, about $300 a month. Of course, this cost is growing far faster than Lincoln's profits. Richard Hallin, the company's vice president then and now, says the pain of paying it has been spread around.
It comes in part from lower wages for the employees. I think it comes from lower profits for the corporation. It comes from trying to find new sources for materials.
On the shop floor, longtime employee Rich Perduta says workers are resigned to both smaller raises and paying part of the insurance tab.
It's a tough pill to swallow, but, you know, you don't really have any control over it. You know, I mean, the company's had to pay a lot more also, so what are you really going to do?
Believe it or not, Lincoln isn't far from typical. Since 1999, small business health insurance premiums have risen 125% nationally. That's less than Lincoln's 200%, but the company's aging workforce is the difference. Many small businesses get extra large premium hikes as their workers age.
John Ehrensmeyer, who heads the advocacy group Small Business Majority, says small employers take an oversized health insurance hit in ways beyond price.
Many times entrepreneurs can't get health insurance because they're too high a risk. If you run a small business and you get rated just based on yourself or a few other employees, you may be out of luck finding affordable insurance at all.
Despite these common problems, the small business community is widely divided over a fix. Gary Claxton surveys health benefits nationwide for the Kaiser Family Foundation. He says small businesses split among those that provide insurance and those that don't provide it or oppose potential insurance mandates for business. Claxton sees national momentum toward broad-based plans like the new ones in Massachusetts and California, where businesses share the burden of insurance costs. But he warns that small business support for such plans can quickly erode in the face of mandates.
There clearly will be some business opposition because most of the proposals that we see do require businesses to do something.
Back in 1999, Richard Hallin at Lincoln Machining surprised me by saying that the country should eventually adopt universal health insurance, not a common view among executives. All the interest groups will fight for another 8 or 10 years, he said, and then they'll decide it's the least bad choice. Well, he was wrong about the timing for universal coverage, but today he's sticking with his prediction of a national plan someday.
I do still think that's the most likely outcome. I don't see a real rational or a real likely alternative to that.
John Ehrensmeyer at Small Business Majority doesn't see a government-backed single-payer plan as the only option, but he says small businesses need a system that guarantees access to affordable health insurance.
And if part of that system involves businesses paying a fair share, we think that's perfectly reasonable. If the society decides that the solution is a single-payer system, well, then that's another way to go.
Of course, that position is directly at odds with many other small business groups. And look around. Big business, labor, and others have their own divisions over health care, which should help you understand why major reform has been so elusive, big price hikes and all. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, parents of teenagers know what a dent in the wallet a set of braces can be. Afterward, the smiles make it all worthwhile, but maybe not $10 million worthwhile. America Ferrera from the hit ABC show Ugly Betty has had her smile insured for that amount. The policy with Lloyd's of London was taken out in Ferrera's name by a tooth care company that's working on a charity with her, which puts her teeth right up there with guitarist Keith Richards' fingers and Marlena Dietrich's legs. And that puts us at the end of the broadcast. It's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 20 points, a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ lost 15 points, two-thirds of 1%. The S&P 500 down 2 points. That's almost two-tenths percent there. Our producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, coming to the defense of the subprime loan.
Credit is a good thing. It allows people to use the services of something without having to pay for it all at once up front.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.